Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Get Into It with Gila. I'm Gila Glassberg, your host, registered dietitian and intuitive eating counselor. And today I have on the Gutman sisters from Hands-On Approach. I had such a fascinating conversation with them. They are actually both OTs, occupational therapists. And you might be thinking, what does OT have to do with intuitive eating? Well, there's actually a major overlap between what they do as OTs and what I do as a dietitian, which you'll hear in the episode. And it's fascinating, like as we referenced in the episode, that we share a client and they were able to do things with her without directly speaking about the food, which really helped her have a healthier relationship with food. So it's just fascinating to view all different areas of healing that can help with all different areas of healing, meaning I help people with intuitive eating and nutrition counseling, and they help them from a totally different perspective, but it could be as efficient or it could be even more powerful to work in two different fields to help somebody with the same issue, which is really, really amazing. So I hope that you'll check it out and you'll listen to it and you'll enjoy it. And go to my website, gilaglassberg.com, to find more recordings like this and webinars. And meanwhile, I'm actually doing a live workshop with my friend and colleague, Rachel Tuckman, this coming up Monday, April 8th, right before Pesach. We are going to get you ready for Pesach. We're going to help you meal plan. We are going to help you write a schedule to really not just think about how you want your Pesach to go, but the leading up to Pesach, your self-care plan, coming from a dietitian's perspective and a therapist's perspective. So go to my website, gilaglassberg.com, to sign up for that. And just a few weeks ago, I did a live webinar with my friend Blimi Heller, and we spoke about how to handle all the candy and nosh that comes up around Purim, but that's really something that you could use all year round. So again, go to my website to purchase that course and look out for more live webinars. I'm really excited. Feel free to email me at gilaglassberg18@gmail.com if you have any ideas for a webinar or something that you're specifically looking to learn. And also, I just wanted to let you guys know that I am working really, really, really hard on an ebook, an e-cookbook that will have over 50 recipes, simple, easy, nourishing recipes. And just keep an eye out for that on the website. And I know you'll enjoy this episode. So stay tuned. Have a good day. Hi, everyone, and welcome to my podcast, Get Into It with Gila. I know you're going to love the content here because you will gain inspiration, powerful tools and insights, and valuable knowledge. If you want more of this, please visit my website at www.gilaglassberg.com or visit me on Instagram at Gila Glassberg. I'm Gila Glassberg, a registered dietitian and intuitive eating counselor. I have come to realize by counseling many, many women that this work is much deeper and greater than food and body image. It's the bigger picture challenges we face of love, belonging, acceptance, what our true values and goals are, noticing them, addressing them, and gaining skills to move forward. If you have been struggling with what your life's purpose is, or you just feel stuck in general and don't know what's holding you back, this podcast will enlighten and inspire you to take action and move forward. This podcast is about other women in the 21st century who feel that losing weight will fix all their problems or somehow meet their unmet needs.
Welcome, everyone. Gila, we are on. We are live on LinkedIn and Instagram. Okay. Let's take it away, Gila. Go for it.
Okay, great. So I've never done a podcast live, so this is like my first, but this is how I always start my podcast. I'm Gila Glassberg, registered dietitian and intuitive eating counselor. And today I have on the Gutman sisters, Amy Gutman and Evelyn Gutman. Thank you guys so much for coming on. This is so fun to do it live. It's like a whole different experience. Okay, so I always start out my podcast with just tell me a little bit about yourself. I like to say, where do you live and what do you do? Like, why? How are you here? You know?
Okay, sounds good. First of all, we're happy to be here. So thank you for having us and inviting us.
So happy. I've heard so much about you and I read about you in magazines and recently I heard about you from a client and I was like, I hope that one day you guys will come on my podcast because like you have so many interesting, like different approaches to share.
Well, thank you for that. That means a lot. Yeah. So I'll tell you just a little bit about us for those of you who are not familiar. My sister and I are known as the Gutman Sisters. We're neurodevelopmental occupational therapists. We specialize in anxiety and processing delays. We help families. We train therapists. We work in organizations. And our background is kind of interesting. You asked where we're from. We're from Brooklyn, New York, grew up in Borough Park, but we have been around the world learning and teaching. And we're just grateful for what it is that we do and understanding how the brain and body work. A little background information. I suffered with sensory integration issues as a child. I was actually working in finance when I went to occupational therapy school simultaneously to heal myself. I did very well in life as far as the outside world. Academically was okay. I have great parents, thank God. There was no trauma that could be labeled as to why I was always feeling intense and anxious. And it was in high school when I was trying to figure out how to help myself because honestly, I was hard to live with. My sister was my witness. She could tell you my functioning and my daily tasks were torturous, although I was able to hide it because I was so smart. I've discovered occupational therapy and I went to OT school to heal myself. And after my life was spared in 9/11 and I was working on Wall Street, I realized that my passion was to really do bigger things in helping the world and making an impact. And I fully committed jumping into it. I started in pediatrics evaluations and with the school system, my sister will tell you her story. We ended up working together in our private practice and that grew into our continuing education company. And now we have a nonprofit where we're aiming towards preventing anxiety and mental health challenges as well. So that's a little bit. Yeah, there's a lot that we do, but go ahead, Evelyn, take it away if you want to share.
Yeah, I want to hear your story, Evelyn, also.
So I originally have a finance background. I have a degree in accounting, and I guess I figured when I was younger that who needs another therapist out there? Like everyone was going into the field, but I've always been fascinated by the brain and how plastic it is. And I remember I was about to get a job in a big six firm, and I'm like, I switched gears, and I'm like, I really don't have passion for accounting. So I switched and I went into occupational therapy. And my sister, living with someone who has sensory integration issues, you don't even realize it at the time when you're so young, like the impact that it can have. But once I started working, also I started in geriatrics. I always knew I wanted pediatrics, but I figured let me start from the top and work my way down. And I worked in with patients who had TBI and strokes. And it was fascinating to me the change that can happen. So once I decided to switch over to pediatrics, which is a whole other story about how that happened, but thankfully I'm in pediatrics and I was working in all the different systems, early intervention, I was working in a clinic, I was working with the Board of Ed, and I saw that a lot of kids were just in the system for too long. Unless they didn't have a diagnosis, they were there for years. My sister was evaluating them. And I would be getting a lot of the kids that she evaluated to treat. And one of our passions was to figure out what the root cause of many of the issues of the kids that we're working with. And that's when we started working together. We took time off. We studied development, physiology, and we got to being where we are right now in our practice, as well as our continuing education company. And our passion, as my sister mentioned, is to prevent anxiety and processing delays in children so that some of the issues are not even there and they can be resolved early.
Wow, that's amazing. Okay, so you guys grew up in Borough Park. Do you still live in Borough Park?
So I live in Manhattan Beach near the ocean and the bay. So I get to go on daily walks and really get into myself.
I'm in Borough Park still. I don't have that view, but I go very frequently to Manhattan Beach.
Got it. That's so nice. Okay. Did you guys ever, like, as kids, did you ever see yourself working together? Like, was this a total shock? Was this like something that you kind of saw happening?
I don't know if it was a shock for me. I don't think we anticipated we would work together. I mean, I know we've had other family members work together in our lives, like our uncle, my father and my uncle. And I don't know. It just evolved. It's like almost like I can't even remember the moment that we said we'd work together. Mm-hmm. But I remember us like having this long conversation, which we always did about like, why are the kids here so long? Like, what are we missing? How can we help the kids? I think that we're both very curious by nature and we're always looking for answers and questioning, and we don't just sit with something just because someone tells us to sit with it. and it just evolved. Amy, do you have a different impression or mindset?
So I will tell you that growing up, I feel like you and I were on different tracks. You know, I did not think we'd be partners. And then as life happens, and I think, by the way, it really leads into what we're talking about with intuitive eating and just understanding neurophysiology. If you really, our whole, by the way, premise is to quiet the noise. It's the name of our podcast. It's the name of our movement. If you really look at what your life is presenting and you don't think about what's expected, but what is your true calling, working with my sister was that. And I did not think it would happen that way, but we were raised by parents who really encouraged us to be creative thinkers and think outside of the box. Even as young kids in school, I was trading stocks at the age of 10. My sister and I, we used to be home exercise. I mean, this really for your audience would be something interesting. We used to get exercise and tennis lessons once a week, you know, in orthodox circles for girls to be busy with that. You know, when they're young, to have that kind of training, our parents are European and they felt that, you know, the gym that was happening in our private schools was not enough. Then they felt that exercise and movement was the key to intelligence and socialization. So we grew up always thinking outside of the box and allowing ourselves to be questioning. So when it came to be that I would be working with my sister, which really was, I think, just as she said, it evolved, it happened to be, we then again allowed our left brain to come into contact where we made sure once we were an organization in 1999, we got a contract in place. We made sure we were business partners to separate that. Because there's a lot that happens when you're working together with family.
Yeah.
And if you want to create impact, you're going to have differences. That's really the truth. And yeah, I'm just, thank you, Gila, for that question and for allowing me to honor the process of where we're at and to share that about my sister and to thank you, Evelyn.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about it now. Wow. 1999. Look at that.
Okay. Yeah. I love like the whole story. Like I will ask you a lot of questions until I fully understand, hopefully. Like the listeners appreciate that too. Cause like you guys have this like whole company now. But like it didn't start like that. Right. But it's interesting. I have a sister. I'm one of nine. I don't know if you guys have other siblings, but I'm one of nine and I have a sister 1 year older than me. We don't work together, but I could see that like synergy, you know, like I'm like one of us, we're both actually pretty creative, but I could just see us both like her idea, my idea, like having fun together. And I'm sure some people who work together, that's not the case, but you guys have this, like, you know, like you, I don't know. I think you both, I believe you both said you were doing something like finance and then you both transitioned to OT, which is so interesting. Right.
Yeah.
And it was very independent. Like, you know, I had gone to OT school to help myself and my switch to going full boat was because of a life changing event that occurred on 9/11 when my life was spared. And for my sister, I don't want to speak on her behalf, but it really was that she wasn't enjoying doing what she was doing. And who needed another therapist?
Yeah.
But she realized she liked science. Go ahead, Evelyn.
Yeah. And I also think like, if I look back, because, you know, hindsight is 20/20, I always gravitated towards the sciences and the health field. But, you know, you make a decision sometimes when you're so young and you're like, okay, I'm going to go against the grain of like what everyone's doing. And I always love numbers, but my passion was there. And it was I'm putting it out there for anyone who needs to make a change in their career. It was a hard thing. I was getting a job. Like I was finally finished CPA and I made a switch to go. And I have to tell you, it's my passion. And even within the field right now, I think when we got into business together, I was at a point where I almost wanted to leave pediatrics because I felt I wasn't making enough impact and change. And it was talking to you and the process of switching to what we do right now and thinking a little bit outside the box and looking for answers that got us, I think, to where we are. And it really literally fuels us, I know me for sure, every single day to continue to do what I do. So I always say like, you can do what you need to do, but when you love what you do, it's an amazing feeling.
I want to just add to that that's such a critical piece because our entire approach, which is called hands-on approaches, and there's not one approach, like a lot of folks always want to know what's the Gutman approach or what's your technique, because we do get success with our clients and with our programming. And it evolved because we were discouraged by what we were practicing, having learned in occupational therapy school and having learned and experienced working in the school system. And it was a recurring theme that we would work with children And we would get results. And then a summer later, after the summer, or maybe when they turned into a teenager, or when they had a new stress or they got sick, they would either regress or have new issues that weren't considered under the OT domain. And we were being questioners. We stopped working for a while and traveled to learn and understand normal development across all fields, speech, wow, psychology, behavior. Wow. And that opened up our eyes to recognize that every individual has a unique brain body profile. So mm-hmm. although we have to have standards in order to test and to perform what it is that we're measuring, looking at a person or connecting to a person or for a person's own journey, whether you're an adult, a parent, you're a leader, you really need to look at that individual profile. And that's what we try and encourage in our talks and in our trainings and in where we mentor and where we supervise and consult, because people think that you need to have a package of what it is that needs to happen. And I think your clients, who is how we connected, having gone through one of our programs, realize that it's not just one piece of knowledge or information right. or action. Right. It's what she needed individually for herself that we were able to allow her to discover on her own. And I think mm-hmm. that's the power in doing this kind of work and connecting with other professionals and recognizing, you know, I don't know everything there is about nutrition. Mm-hmm. A dietitian sometimes has to be called into play, and behavior mm-hmm. and issues are not always because of OT. Sometimes there is a need for a psychologist or a psychiatrist. We need to understand each profile uniquely. And that's mm-hmm. the key to getting personal change that lasts. And yeah, mm-hmm. thank you for bringing that up, because just in yeah. hearing you, yeah.
Okay. First of all, that's such a cool name, Hands-On Approach. I love that, because it's like, first of all, I'm always looking for like a good tagline and a good name for my business. And it's like, that really encompasses what you're trying to do. Like, it's a hands-on approach. And like you said before, every person's so different. And of course, for me, what's coming up is that like, this is so similar to like the intuitive eating journey and process that like Evelyn Triboli and Elise Resch went on when they wrote the book. I don't know if you're familiar with the authors, but basically they were working in the field of nutrition, private practice, putting people on diets, or they call it like sensible meal plans, like not even trying to get them to be so restrictive. You know, you could have one cookie, not two, whatever. And like you, like Amy, you kind of just said that, like, yeah, they would get results, quote unquote, meaning people would lose weight in the short term, but they would always come back having gained back the weight plus more, but not just weight. It was like this added sense of guilt and shame and body hatred and frustration. And I'm not exaggerating. Like, my clients come to me with such self-loathing and internalization of like, it's my fault. I lack self-control. What's wrong with me? I did it once. Why can't I do it again? Whereas like a diet is so black and white, and a one nutrition approach is so black and white. That's not how it works. You know, we don't all fit into a box, like none of us do. So it's, right. I see like such a, you know, overlap between those two things.
100%. I mean, that is really the essence of anything that we're thinking about, whether it's food, whether it's going to be time management, but how much more so to food. And I would love to get a little bit deeper, Gila, into why, when it comes to food, that's really where we get stuck in that loop response. And what you mentioned, those points of shame and guilt and self-doubt come into play. Is connected to something that's really basic for our survival. But mm-hmm. in today's culture, it's become more than us eating to live. We're also having the perception of what the world is looking upon us, how we're being viewed by our spouses, perhaps our children, perhaps our workers. The whole society is really viewing us based on how we're eating, what we're eating. And then that's one component. And then individually, there's that physiological piece that as many times as we try to work on dieting or working on food control,
yeah,
we end up hurting ourselves and sabotaging. There's a reason. There's a real neurophysiological reason. And as much as we're hearing it, let's say, right, if you're listening to the world and they're saying, feel your body, feel what you need to do. For some of us, that's hard, impossible. And there's a struggle in that. So we need to mm-hmm. really identify what's that root cause for that. Yeah, Evelyn, I'm sorry. Yeah. I didn't want to interrupt you.
No. I agree with you on that. I feel like we need to talk about this a little bit more and understand a little bit more. Because I think we can sometimes be so influenced by others out there and what the culture or what people are saying. And it's hard sometimes to sort of like what we are thinking is quiet the noise and really understand that there's physiologically a root cause for everything. Every single person is different. And to really like to get rid of the shame and the feeling of, You have to do what's good for you and understand why you're doing it. And to be confident in that and secure in that in order to make the changes that we each individually need for ourselves.
So for people who are listening, I'm not even sure if they know what you mean when you say like everything's like physiologically going on. So could you, I guess like I'm giving you guys the floor now. Could you explain to us like what you do, I guess, like generally speaking, and then how we could, I really want to hear about how you guys have this whole approach to food, because like I think that is kind of like I'm always looking for the missing piece when I tell people like, you know, tune into your hunger, tune into your fullness, and like there's a gap, because it's for me, I see it as like they've been dieting for forever, but I'm sure there's so many different reasons that I'm not privy to and I want to hear.
Sure. So I guess I'll start the role, okay. Just start from the beginning. We'll do something a little bit more easy just to understand, and then we'll get deeper into the parts that have to do with food. So the first thing then is that our brain and our body, we know that we have genetics and we have nurture, right? Which is coming from our caregivers in the world. But physiologically, or how is our body responding to information from outside the scope of nurture and genetics, relies on three components. Our sensory integration systems, which are our eight senses, not our five senses. Let me tell you the eight senses. There's the five that you know, your sense of vision, your auditory sense for hearing, olfactory sense for smelling, gustatory sense, which is taste, and tactile sense, which is touch. And then we have three hidden systems. One of them is called the proprioceptive system, which is our system that allows us to tell us where our joints are in place, our vestibular system, which is our sense of balance, and a very important one called the interoceptive system, which is the awareness of how our organs internally are communicating with our brain. Our liver, our bladder, our stomach, our sweat glands, our adrenals, those components are continuously communicating with our brain. And these systems develop in utero. Way before we put one piece of food into our mouth, we are getting those development of how those systems work. The second piece to understand our physiology or how our brain and body communicate is reflex integration. You touched on something called MNRI before we got online together. There are lots of different approaches, INPP, rhythmic movement, lots of different philosophers. We actually know all the creators of these programs. They actually started back in the 1970s. My sister and I, we were doing reflex integration way back before it became popular. And it's important to recognize that reflexes, which are what we're born with during the first year of life. Evelyn, why don't you explain a little about reflex, and then I'll explain.
Sure. We are all born with certain reflexes. We have primitive reflexes, which are basically there to help us survive. Think about a baby. When they're born into the world, they're bombarded by all the sensory information. They don't have muscle tone. They don't have the ability to really do what they need to. So these reflexes are there to help protect the baby and help them move through movement patterns, get acclimated to the world. You know, our fight or flight response that we all talk about is really something that we're born with. It's a primitive response. And as the baby gets used to being in the world and gets to integrate their systems, these reflexes are supposed to go away and higher ones are supposed to come in. And the purpose of the reflexes are that many of them have to do with movement, but many of them have to do with our basic forms of survival that are tied to things like our motivation, our hunger drive, our sleeping patterns, our sexual drive. So there's a lot of stuff that goes on in the beginning in terms of regulating ourselves and the nuances when it comes to that brain and body connection with the reflexes.
And then the third component, so we spoke about sensory integration systems, reflex integration. And by the way, there's a lot of other sensory systems that impact food also, which we can get deeper into.
Yes, I would love to hear.
The third area is the neurochemical development. How do we develop the release of our dopamine and our serotonin that allows us to get motivated, initiated, feeling calm and organized? So when you think about those three components, it's a very unique brain profile for all of us. So even if we have the same nurture and we're siblings, you can have a different physiological profile. We see it over and over again. You mentioned you're one of nine. We have families where we treat children and the symptoms are the same. They're having the same issues, maybe with regulation or not feeling organized or distracted or unmotivated. And within the same family, same parents, same genetics, three different profiles. One person, one child might need our help, but in one way, a second one will have a different program and a third may not even need what we're providing. So for an adult, if you're not aware of your own physiology, how powerful it is when we do programs like the self-regulated life, which is what your client went through, we're not focusing necessarily on teaching the systems or the reflexes or the neurochemical development, but teaching them ways for them to learn how to identify that for themselves and shift what they need to. Because we all know that when we are, there's a difference between even intuitive eating and mindful eating, I would imagine. I'm not so familiar with the terms, but being mindful means that you're being aware of what it is you're eating and what it is that you're feeling while you eat. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that intuitive eating also has to do with a sense like, am I even hungry to begin with? Let's take one step before the experience. Like, is this, you know, we talk about emotional eating. We talk about different ways of needing to satisfy our needs. But if we don't use our brain and our cognitive components, and we can use our physiology, how powerful that is. Because that's our instinctive response, right? We're first crying for food because of a physiological need. No one told us cry for food and get fed and you will grow hair and your brain will grow and all that. It's an actual basic need. And if that's been interrupted for someone, then that may inhibit their ability to be in tune to what it is that they're feeling. They may not know what it means to really be hungry when we talk about that, or what they feel in the moment of emotions, because being sad or happy is not a real term for our body. It's what we bring taught and how we perceive the world, and what my happiness is different for you, what my sadness is different for you, but our body responds to what it needs to in that moment. So intuitive eating and the physiological response are very much connected, because if we're not in tune to our physiology, then sometimes we may not know that we're having that lack of awareness of where we stand with hunger, where we stand with thirst, where we stand with our frustrations, our emotions. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Actually, I just want to jump in for a second. Okay, so first of all, mindfulness is a component of intuitive eating, but intuitive eating, there's 10 principles and they're all designed to help the client have a healthy relationship with food. So it's funny because the way that I like to teach it is I teach my clients about hunger fullness, like based on the hunger fullness scale. I'm not sure if you're familiar, but it's like a hunger rate. It's a scale from 0 to 10, 0 being ravenously starving, think fast day, and 10 is like painfully stuffed, possibly nauseous. You might have to unbutton your skirt. Those are like the two extremes, right? So when I ask clients, are you hungry now? When was the last time you ate? What does it feel like in your body? Some could identify and some could not. Like I say, you know, we tend to think of hunger as our stomach growling, but that's very often a more extreme form of hunger, right? They don't think that. Or let's say, I want to hear more about it from your perspective, but let's say when you said like things interfere with that, for my clients, things that have interfered with that is a parent potentially saying, you can't be hungry, you just ate, or take one more bite, you got to have your protein, right? So, or dieting, just in general, dieting, telling them like, I really shouldn't eat this, all the guilt and shame. So they don't really even know what hunger feels like. And my job is to help them figure that out based on the hunger fullness scale and give them, you know, you could feel hunger in your mood change. You could feel hunger in your head. You could start thinking about food more. And of course, that could also just be because you're bored or because a learned behavior. And then when they learn like a lot about physical hunger and fullness, then I'm like, okay, now let's talk about emotional hunger, because now you have a really good sense of like, when you get that hunger cue, when you do feel hangry, when you do feel like you have a headache, check in, when was the last time that you ate? So I try really hard to like give them that physical foundation of hunger fullness. And then they could, at least they could differentiate, like, this is not physical hunger. This is because I'm bored, I'm upset, I'm anxious. And sometimes they could use another coping strategy and sometimes they can't, but that's part of the learning process.
100%. I was going to say, like, listening to you and when you were talking about people perceiving their hunger and they may not even know it. And going back to childhood, if you think about what we just discussed, that when we are developing as children, if everything is developing okay, and we have our hunger drive in check, which, by the way, many people have to consider, they may not have that in check looking back at childhood. If they've had anxiety or they've had feeding issues, remember, everything has to work in balance of all three things working, those three areas working well together. But let's say everything was going okay with their hunger drive. Children innately, they get hungry, they cry, so we feed that need. And if you allow it to progress in a healthy way where you're looking at the choices that they want, of course, parents have to be mindful and give the right choices, but you're giving them choice of what they should be eating. You're not telling them they have to finish the bite. You're not, you're letting them leave something on the plate and asking, so do you feel like you want to eat more? And you're really, really tuning them into those hunger cues. That's how that's the beginning part of a healthy relationship with food. Happens to be, as time goes with culture in terms of what people are telling us, or I think even children when they start school and they see what other kids are eating, or I can't believe, I mean, I hear like 9-year-olds, the way that they're talking about food.
I know.
I'm fat. I have to be skinny. I can't eat that. I have to. It breaks my heart, because that's where we start messing up them actually having the right hunger drive and listening to the cues of their own body before we allow culture and everything else to come into play. Because it's a very hard thing to undo. Like you said, when you're an adult and you're trying to work on intuitive eating or just dieting, whatever that means. You see, dieting is a diet, but diet just means to me, I'm looking to be healthier and lose some weight. So can I do it in the best way possible where I'm actually respecting my body's cues, but eating well and healthy, where psychologically I'm also not allowing myself to get into these places where if I'm going to fail, it's going to be horrible. Right. Yeah. You want to say
something? I want to lean into the word dieting, which is really why, in essence, that word doesn't really explain healthy eating. It's like I'm not sure about your audience. I know some people are like, you know, don't tell me not to diet. And I get it, by the way, because I'm sorry, what were you saying, Gila? I don't know if I'm.
No, nothing. I thought you were. No. I. You know what? We let's talk it out. I'm saying I don't actually promote weight loss, like intentional weight loss, and I definitely don't put people on diets. But yeah, there is a little bit of semantics here. What does dieting even mean? And but yeah. Anyways, I want to hear what you're gonna say.
Okay, so what I was gonna say is like whether you're putting yourself on a diet, you're really denying that physiological state when you do that. Like it's right. really denying, like by telling yourself that you're only going to restrict the calories and whatever it is, you are forcing yourself to be in a place where you're avoiding everything we spoke about. Oh, I lost Gila there. She's back.
Yeah.
Okay. You're avoiding everything that we spoke about, recognizing your physiology and your components. But let's remember and honor those who do feel like they need a diet. And when they hear the word intuitive eating, it's foreign to them. There's a reason for that. I want to honor those folks as well,
because
you're doing that because perhaps your regulatory response and your physiology and your stress loop, not talking about your cognitive stress. What we're talking about is those reflexes, that interoception, that proprioception. You're in that response. You need the restrictions and the control of a plan in a very set way, and not even maybe for weight loss. Maybe it's just for your health, or maybe it's just for you want to get into a dress in 3 months from now. You need that. And I'm saying this as a person who's saying it like air, meaning like you need it like the air that you're breathing, because having to be told to feel your hunger cues and whatever it might be way too much. And I think that that's where our approach, because we don't have an approach to eating in that way at all. Like, for example, your client didn't come to us for eating issues. She came to learn how to get regulated. It's through understanding how our body and brain work and physiologically recognizing our need, we tap into the power of us being able to shift the schemas that we have, both from outside sources, our parents and the society, as well as our own personal experience of having lived life. Routine weight loss, routine dieting, routine restrictions. These schemas, just to finish the thought, because while you were talking, Gilan, I heard you saying about those words that parents will say to a child, you've had enough, or you don't need any more, there's not enough protein. That is an external schema that will shift a child's physiology. In that moment, a stress response and loop, we're talking not stress in the mind, but in the body, will be created because they may have been hungry. And when we cut off that proprioceptive or interoceptive system, or we cut off the neurochemicals that we may have needed in that moment of feeling the sensation of being satisfied fully, right? The connection between our stomach. By the way, our stomach has 90% of our nervous system and our serotonin. It's developed there. So if you're telling a person at that point when they're 9, they could be a 39-year-old suffering with yo-yo dieting, weight loss issues, addictive tendencies. Because that physiological response is what they know. They don't know better. You could talk to them till you're blue in the face. You could give them plans, But physiologically, their body has memory. The body keeps score. That is, there is a lot of science that shows us that. So I just want to delve like a little bit deeper into the nuance that if someone doesn't connect to these words of intuitive eating or dieting, or they connect too strongly, they have too strong of an opinion, there might be a reason for that, because you can connect to your own physiology to get there. Yeah, sorry, Evelyn. I was just getting a little passionate about that.
I love that. I'm writing something down because I don't want to forget, but I want to hear what you're going
to
say,
Evelyn. No, I was just going to bring it down a little bit more as we're having the conversation. I guess to put it very simply, I feel like a lot of times individuals don't realize that when your body is in a stress response, and this can happen for some people in childhood, this can happen when they're getting older. When you're in that stress response, many times the hunger drive gets affected. So you really do not know whether you're hungry or whether you're not. How many people?
I've heard that 100 times from clients. I don't know if I'm anxious or I'm hungry. I've heard it 100 million times.
And there is a direct link between anxiety and the fact that it could inhibit us from knowing, are we thirsty? Are we hungry? Are we tired? All these basic physiological functions that we need to really be do well optimally. We need the food, we need the sleep for the energy source, the food, the sleep to allow our body to regenerate and consolidate information. And then what ends up happening is, like my sister said, you get into this loop response where the stress response becomes stronger. And where you are in stress is where your hunger is going to be at. How many people, when they're in stress, they eat more? They're not hungry. Right. They're not listening to the hunger drive. It's just a defense mechanism or a coping mechanism that they use. Or some people will be like, I'm not hungry at all. And they will not listen to their thing that they're hungry until they're passing out. And I have to say, we have that a lot with our clients. For many of our clients, it's about being able to organize themselves in a way where you're quieting that stress response. And then you have to say, okay, what am I feeling? And many of them will not feel anything. Like you said, they won't know even when they're not stressed, because they're so used to being in a certain way that it's like, okay, I don't really need to eat. Or they're not eating because they need to eat. They're eating because I will tell them, okay, now I want you to go and I want you to eat breakfast. Or I want you to. And I think that part of whatever it is anyone does for, I'm not even going to use the word diet, for eating every single day and being in tune with our basic needs, is being able to regulate and organize ourselves so that we allow those cues to come in. Because anyone who's anxious, like my sister said, their interoceptive system, identifying what the cues are, is going to be a little bit off. And it's going to cause that sometimes even more of a stress response. Imagine that you don't know if you're hungry or you're not, and then you're like, do I eat? Do I not eat? And it becomes hard for that person.
And what's interesting is that when you work on the systems, that, I mean, we can tell you from our own experience, we ask parents, are they hungry or are they thirstier? And they're always confused. Like, if you're working on their vestibular system, why are you asking about their hunger drive?
Yeah.
And we're explaining to them, because through that regulatory response physiologically, instead of us using our mind and sharing with them, the person has the freedom to feel. Like, I just want to explain to you how powerful that is, because I know for myself that I can turn this switch on and off, not by me deciding, oh, I'm going to eat well now for the next 3 months or 5 months or forever. It matters that I take a day-to-day step to be connected to who Amy is physiologically. So then I can go to my choices of, oh, I know this is not healthy, or let me enjoy this piece of chocolate fully. And I don't even have to be conscious about it. I don't have to sit there and say, oh, do I want this piece of chocolate or not? Physiologically, I'm present. And if it appeals to me, I'm going to have a piece of chocolate. And I'm not going to eat a lot too much of it, not because of someone telling me it's bad for me, but because I'm not going to feel that I need it. I'm not going to feel that I want it. They're going to get the taste that I appreciate, and that's it. And it's okay. And you know what? And if I do want to eat 10 pieces of chocolate in that moment, that's also okay. It just means, am I doing this because of I'm in tune to who I am? Again, I'm not sure how this goes over in the global community, but we feel it's important for that person to be in a regulatory state in order to access what their true feeling is in the relationship to food. It's not a bad or good thing if I'm eating chocolate. It doesn't mean anything. It's what's happening in that moment. Okay, yeah. I'm listening. I want to hear from you because you're.
I have a lot to say. I think that a lot of the things that you guys are saying are things that I actually teach my clients. Like, I'm sure there are gaps in what I teach just because I don't know everything that you're saying. I mean, I really do know a lot of the things that you're saying, but one thing I wanted to say before is that, okay, basically I have clients who have been dieting forever, right? Let's say it was 10 years, 20 years, 30 years since they're 9 and now they're 60, right? Some people not so long, but like the, you know, I could have somebody dieting for a year or dieting for 50 years. So what happens with intuitive eating is that there's no diet. So there's really no structure of eating, technically. What I do as a dietitian is that I look over the way that they're eating and I teach them about the hunger fullness scale, and I teach them about their hunger fullness cues, plus like all the other emotional stuff, like, oh, okay, your trigger is every time your kids scream, like you can't handle the noise, that's like, you know, being dysregulated, then you just have to put something in your mouth, right? So I could come at it at a bunch of angles. I could also work with their therapist as well, you know, like, okay, maybe that person maybe you need to leave the room. Sometimes you can't leave the room. Maybe you need to get a babysitter at the time, whatever, all that type of stuff, right? But people really do need, I don't want to call it a diet, let's say a meal plan, because they need the structure of eating, like you said. So I do see that with clients. And I always tell them, this is not a diet. This is, I call it like a flexible meal plan. So we have a spreadsheet and some clients like to map it out the whole week. Some clients just like meal ideas, snack ideas. And I see that different clients, you know, work so differently, but I do see that with a lot of clients, they struggle to go from that rigid dieting to a little bit more flexibility because they really do need the structure. Some people, I mean, we know, like, I have 4 kids. I'm 1 of 9. Like, some people really, like, they just don't eat because they just don't have time. Obviously, that's not functional. But, like, they come back every single week and they're like, yeah, I can't eat breakfast. Yeah, I can't. And I'm like, I'm not sure if there's anything more that I could tell you other than you're probably going to binge at lunch because you didn't eat breakfast. So, you know, there's, like, but sometimes, yes, maybe there is something deeper going on. And that's why. That's why I love, like, I just to pull one more thing in that, like, I have a good friend who does somatic therapy, and I just interviewed her on the podcast, and she's always telling me, like, she's like, Gila, like, it's not always cognitive. Like, sometimes there really is something going on deeper. And when she said that to me and we've been talking about it, I'm like, it really makes so much sense. I'm not a therapist and I can't do somatic therapy on people, but sometimes it really is that I could teach you from today till tomorrow. It's because you've been on a diet for 40 years and we have to really reframe your thoughts and change those neural pathways like you've been reinforcing over and over again. But therefore, when that client told me that you guys helped her with regulating her eating, I was like, there is a missing piece here, you know?
So I'm getting excited listening to you because, first of all, I'm resonating with the clients that you're talking about because I had that issue as well where I would forget to eat. And again, I'm going to lean into this and share with everyone publicly again. When I am not in that physiological place of regulation, the old patterns will come in because our cognitive brain is what it is that gives us that security and safety. We can say to ourselves, well, in this moment, I can shut down my body and brain because, hey, they've been with me all my life and I need to get the task done of what I need to do with the dishes in the sink, the final deadline, whatever it is. We shut down ourselves. We're punishing ourselves, but not cognitively, physiologically. Right. So if we put an emphasis, and I want to share just for anyone who's listening, even with regard to your client, when people go through the programs that we teach, we've been running the self-regulated life. We're doing it now. It's the 6th time now. We have different ways of doing it. Every cohort that comes, we always say, we're going to present ideas to you and some of it is going to resonate. And for others, you're going to be like, this does not work. And that makes sense.
Right.
Because your physiology is unique to you. So what I'm going to do, what Amy's going to do, what Emily's going to do in Gila in order to get into that state of equilibrium is going to be unique. So being on the other side where you're teaching them the skill sets, it's twofold, regulation and also initiation and motivation, which is what that somatic therapist friend of yours was saying. It's not cognitive. Sometimes we're not able to sustain the motivation, not because of our situation in life, but because of our physiology. We have loop responses that have to do with these systems and reflexes and neurochemical components that impact that as well. We see it from, not to be extreme, but Holocaust survivors who were able, they talk about how they were able to feel happiness. And when they ate a potato, it was like eating a full meal. And others were seeing it as if they were starving. The potato was a potato. So was it the stress response that was happening externally? How are they integrating that physiologically? They could have been told, be happy, be full, Some felt it, some didn't. We talk about a prisoner of wars. Studies are shown over and over again. The connection of our olfactory system with food. How many individuals are highly sensitive to smells that create an impulsive, repetitive event for them to continue eating? Imagine if someone has that awareness and they're able to do certain movements before they go to an event or a meal that's going to curtail that. What power that is to understand how your brain and body work to help you when you're going through those stumbling blocks.
I just wanted to like build on that, because as I was listening to you, Gila, and you're talking, Amy, that when you were talking about the client, that sometimes they don't have the time, or you just said you don't have the time, or, you know, there's so much noise and I feel like I need to put something in my mouth in order to eat. I think that part of eating has to be really listening to the other cues that you're picking up physiologically as well. And I'll give you the perfect example of someone that we have not started working with yet, a young girl, 19 years old, just met her the other week. She does not eat breakfast. She wakes up with a little queasiness. Her stomach hurts a little bit. So she already is in that stress response. So I was telling her, like, we're going to work on that in terms of regulating herself. But she didn't realize that she's highly sensitive to the movements that her head makes in terms of creating that stress response. If she bends down, she gets a little dizzy and nauseous. She doesn't realize it. Because we protect ourselves. Most of us will bend a different way. But if she's caught off guard, so she's already in the morning feeling off. So is she going to eat breakfast? No, she's not hungry because she's physiologically feeling queasy. So allowing someone also to say, you know what, that may not be the time for you to eat. I told her, I'll give you a piece, have a glass of like lemon water. Just, we have other issues going on. That's going to help you. And then when you get to your place of work, change your time schedule, that you may eat a little bit later, but you're going to eat something, knowing at that point, because we went through, when are you feeling a little bit better? She's like, when I get to work, I feel a little bit better. That's when breakfast needs to be, because that's when you're listening to the cues of hunger without the other cues affecting you. Now, my goal with Amy will be to work on regulating her and getting rid of that physiological piece of like, I just can't handle movement. Things that I see in my environment are affecting the way I perceive what's going on with my body. Those things really affect our ability to know we're hungry, to know we don't want to do anything. We just want to like, just be, you know what I'm saying? Survive, so to speak. Can't really eat well when you're in survival mode. You're not eating intuitively, so to speak. You're eating so I think we really, it's not just about food. It's about like really taking a moment to be. And if it's sound, there's something you can do for sounds that are bothering you. Yeah, you may want to use your mouth, which, by the way, it's very innate that you're going to put something in your mouth when you're highly sensitive to sound, because something happens when you're chewing that actually enables your ear to quiet the sounds that you're hearing. Maybe it shouldn't be food. Maybe it should be something else. Or maybe when you're being triggered, you have a specific food that you're like, okay, I'm going to take a cucumber and I'm going to cut it up. Not because I'm hungry, by the way, but because a cucumber is something that's crunchy enough that's going to help me quiet the sound so I can function and then sit down for my meal.
It's so powerful what you're saying. Oh, I heard a backdrop. It's so powerful what you're saying, because we know that eating is important. We know that sleep is important. Everybody wants to get up early in the morning and everybody wants to be in bed, you know, getting that high quality sleep. But some of us actually perform better when we're up at night and when we get up later. It's just the quantity of sleep that we need at different times. Honoring that system is important until we switch to that system. So for this client, we need to honor the fact that this is what she's dealing with physiologically right now. And the moment we push breakfast down her throat, or if her mother had done that when she was younger, we would have been creating schemas of eating patterns that are going to go beyond the time of us addressing the physiological approach. And the language that we use is so important, not just from how we're speaking to others, but to ourselves. What is she telling herself when she says, I'm so queasy and I have a headache, so I can't eat breakfast? That may not be connected, which Evelyn, you just shared. The reason she's queasy perhaps is because her vestibular system is at play. And when she has to bend down, she's getting triggered. Her stomach is responding to it and it's preventing her from being able to get the nutrition she needs first thing in the morning. But imagine if we started also working on the language, right? it's both ways. Our body and brain have to work both ways. The somatic therapist is going to work bottom up and Gila is going to work top bottom. Very critical to get both of those in place so that we can function, because nobody changes overnight and these are baby steps, but we need to honor both of those components so we don't impact our self-esteem and our view of ourselves. Because if we're not honoring it, we're going to end up with shame and guilt every time we fail, every time we have a problem. And I think that that's something that when we speak to other professionals, particularly psychologists, we always share with them that don't always think that it's always a certain scenario. It may be that that person just needs to be spoken in a different way to tap into what their needs are. Not everything is significant trauma from experience. It could be physiological trauma. It could be an experience that they view as traumatic and another person would not. Our perception is based on how we interpret our physiology. It's dependent on it. It really is. So it's yeah. So that's our viewpoint on eating. And I think it's an amazing thing that you're in this field, Gila, because you're allowing people to have ownership over one of the basic needs that is not just about food, but it's about health. It's about perception. It's about their who they are and their self image. There's a lot.
Totally. I mean, everything that you're saying is totally like so similar to what I teach as an intuitive eating dietitian. It's like crazy. I still think like people look at me like I have like 100 heads when I tell them like, oh, we don't focus on weight, or like, yeah, you could listen to your body, hunger, fullness. Maybe I can teach you some other regulating skills. Maybe that's why you're always eating, because you were always dieting, and then when you eat, it becomes much more rewarding and blah, 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 all that stuff. But I want to say one more thing about eating disorders that, you know, I'm sure you guys know that like an eating disorder is a symptom of something deeper, right? So when somebody numbs on hunger or they binge and they numb on fullness, they're actually regulating themselves in some way, even though it's really hurting them. And people don't know that. And to me, it's always been very fascinating. And I struggled with my own disordered eating. And when I hear my clients talk about it, I'm right there with them, because I totally, totally understand it. I also totally, like, my life's mission is just to help them get to the other side, because it's so painful to think that you're the one that's, you're binging because something's wrong with you, or like you just can't stop eating chocolate or whatever. Like, that's all because of, from my perspective, a lot because of the dieting, because of the shame, because of the all the systems that you have in place now, that the reason why you're using food, the reason why you might be gaining weight, the reason why you might be binging. So it's just people really don't know this. And when they think of a dietitian, they think the dietitian's going to tell me what to eat and what not to eat. And even from what you guys were just saying, like the hands-on approach, like it's very disrespectful to a client. That's what intuitive eating is about. Like, I'm not the expert of your body. You're the expert of your own body. I can give you tools. I can give you skills. I can give you ideas, but I'm here to coach you to figure it out. And it's really very similar to what you guys are saying.
100%. I think the only difference is in our angle is that we don't even talk about the food, right? Right. We don't even touch the food. We say, let's get to a regulatory response. And I love that you brought up the science behind eating disorders, because when in our field, at least when you look at the research of trying to see the connections between those who are suffering with that, we see, let's say, one system is clearly at play, which is the vestibular system. And the vestibular system is directly connected to our emotional centers of our brain. So when a person is not regulated vestibularly, they're going to take things to heart much more, have urgency, be highly sensitive internally, and that can create lack of control. So what do? We control food intake. We take the one thing we can do. And it's been fascinating. And I wonder if, you know, we were to explore a little bit deeper on this to understand that, even if a person were to know that that's the case, meaning we know that we're eating or controlling food because of maybe a situation that occurred, maybe because of our physiological response and how we cope, whatever the cause and the root cause may be, it's critical for them to realize that their need for control may be stemming from a physiological source as well. And it's not them. It's how they're developed. It's how it takes away the point of self-blame. It's like a person who's been through a traumatic crisis, or they're having poor relationships with their parents and they want to control food growing up. That's their one area. This root source is not going to be what we're talking about, physiological. It's going to be psychological. Your relationship with your parent is the root cause. if it's physiological and that's how your body relates to control because of itself. And you don't even know, we've had children in our practice, teenagers who've had eating disorders, and they'll say, I don't know why I eat. They're coming in with their parents who love them, who care for them, who accept them fully. And they're like, I don't know, but I need to control that. It's the one. Mm-hmm. And then we work on the physiological response. And that's why I was saying, we always ask the question from parents, did their eating increase? Are they thirstier? And parents are like, yeah, you know, I didn't even realize. And we're like, well, that's why sometimes and we need to be respectful of all of it. And OTs, if you're listening, don't get stuck that everything having to do with eating is physiological. Sometimes there's a psychological trauma, and make sure you're honoring that, because as soon as you reach the point where you think it's your box and your frame of reference, you're in trouble and you're not serving fully. And I think that every single person, that's where that unique approach comes into play, where you say, what do you need? Like, your client resonated with certain challenges or exercises clearly, because we have a chat that allows us to engage with them fully while they're experiencing it. And she did not resonate with others. And there's a reason. It's her physiology. It's her unique experience. We need to really honor that.
Yeah. That's speaking to me very much on like an individual level, not even on a personal level. I mean, I would love to like just learn more from you guys and explore. Hopefully I can use it with my clients, because it's like, there, I always did feel that there's like some sort of gap with intuitive eating. And there's gaps in so many different systems, but like for me, right? So I said, I'm the fourth of nine. I didn't live at home when I was in high school. I developed this very severe disordered eating. Baruch Hashem never turned into an eating disorder, but like those OCD tendencies that I was able to like use food to grab onto. And this is like, just sounds funny, but like it was always like the big joke in high school that Gila has a sensitive body. Like I would always be like, don't touch my arm, I'm really sensitive. And like, I also am really sensitive. Like I get like emotionally, like if somebody insults me or like I'll obsess about things and like replay it in my head. Thank God, you know, therapy goes a long way. But if somebody would like touch my arm and I'd be like, stop, you're hurting me. They're like, I'm not hurting you. And then like the next day I would have a black and blue mark on my arm. Or like, for example, when I gave birth, this happens to me every single time. I go into the hospital, they're trying to get my IV in, and my husband's like, it's not going to work in her hand. It will never work in her hand. And the nurse was like, oh my gosh, come on, whatever. And then he's like, I'm telling you, it's not going to work. It never works. It always pops. They always have to try the other arm. It pops. Like, it sounds so funny, like when I say it out loud, but like the people in my life are like, no, you actually have a sensitive body that matches your sensitive personality. So like that emotion, like that dysregulation, when all my kids are talking to me, like I literally feel like my whole system shuts down and I'm like, I can't hear you. Like I know from learning about all this stuff that there's something going on, but like as a high schooler, even in my younger 20s, I felt so bad about myself. Why can't I tolerate noise? You know?
Right.
Well, Gila, I just want to, before you go, Evelyn, I just want to say like, I'm getting emotional listening to you, and my sister could tell you that I used to, and my sister doesn't like it when I say it, but I used to express it as if I felt like I had knives in my back. And when she hear, like when the world hears that, they might think, oh, you're extremist or they're, that's what I felt. Like when I had these sensations, they're so, so intense. Sorry, Evelyn.
I want to honor you, Gila, just in for what you do and in the way you just expressed yourself. And I was listening to you, I was also getting emotional, because for me, I feel that so many people experience things like that with their body. And it has to do with being in tune and understanding that this is what I'm going through and having it acknowledged. And I think for a lot of people, and I think this is a big part of also what we do, while we do treat the physiology, one of my biggest goals, and I'll take this example that I gave of this 19-year-old, is to really honor and acknowledge that, yes, it makes sense. That is why you're going through this. Your auditory system is in hyperdrive, maybe because you experience things through movement. You know, they're both in the ear. Maybe you're having more of a fight or flight response. And when you understand that there's a connection and that there's a reason that can cause also why you're eating versus the fact that I'm not really hungry, people need to know that. It may not give you the solution. It may not really solve the physiological reason, but it allows you to pause and say, hey, I'm not hungry. I feel that pain. I have an overly sensitive body because perhaps I have A, X, Y, and Z, or I'm experiencing dysregulation through my sensory systems, or perhaps I have a heightened fight or flight response. So my nervous system is always in overdrive. And it sort of like allows you to see things the step from the root of like, what can I do to change that, whether it's cognitive, hopefully physiological, whatever it works for everyone, because some people will go the physiological route and some people will go the cognitive route. And that's okay if it's yielding the results you need. But being able to do that, so many other things that we're struggling with become easier. It gives us more mindfulness and intention and being able to really be there and present with why am I not eating? Why am I choosing to eat? And I think that a lot of people don't get that. They put it on themselves. I'm blaming myself. Right. But why? Right. Like, what's the reason?
Well, dieting teaches you that, you know, dieting tells you, like, if you try hard enough, you could be a size 2. If you try hard enough, then you wouldn't eat chocolate. That's literally the messaging that we're getting.
Right. Which is powerful.
Well, I think then everyone needs to get a little bit of a developmental lesson in play to understand. And I think this has to start honestly from the ground up. And that's why I'm so grateful for organizations out there that are doing about, you know, more discussions with our young girls and boys, by the way. I want to not avoid talking about the young boys that are being impacted by this as well. It's not immune to that gender either. And I think it's important that we start kind of talking. And I, again, like my sister said, hearing 9-year-olds talk about, I need to lose weight and I need to go on a diet. I cringe. I'm going to share personally that I grew up and I was a little heavy girl. Apparently I never knew it. I never knew that there was an issue. My parents didn't speak about it in any way of restrictions. I didn't feel the cultural effect of that. I always felt that I was beautiful the way I am, and it wasn't based on what my size was. And now I'm raising daughters, and thank God, I'm hoping I'm giving them that lesson. But I'm hearing their friends talk. I'm hearing my daughter share with me that girls in her class, she's in 5th grade now, are on diets, and I am cringing. I am like sad because they're supposed to be developing. What do you mean? Yeah. They are developing. They're about to go into puberty, where we want them to be free and allow themselves to feel their neurochemicals coming and their hormones and everything that's supposed to be happening. And we're squashing them. And again, I don't want to get into everything here, but the screens that our kids are being exposed to and adults are being exposed to, that impacts your physiological responses and your regulation. So the younger generation, besides for the screens that they're getting physically, the damage, the messages that they're getting of what they should honor and who they should respect based on size and all that. I mean, that's like a whole other topic. We can get, you know, a bunch of other folks in that discussion, but we're really creating schemas that will last. I'm having to be busy now with my little ones to counterbalance what they're hearing in school. My mother didn't have to have this discussion with me when I was growing up, but I need to. And by the way, the moment that you think like you're doing a good job, I just want to tell parents out there, I'm not a parenting expert because I have not parented thousands. We're very good at understanding how to communicate with kids based on their brain profile, but no offense to any parenting coaches or anyone out there. I think unless you've been parent to 1,000 kids, I don't think that you can have the rule on knowing what to say. One thing I'll say for sure in having worked with thousands of children and hands-on with hundreds of families, make sure that you're always proactive and preventative. Don't think that if you hear from your daughter something and it your gut and your intuition is telling you that doesn't resonate with me, I'm just going to poo-poo it and put it on the side. Your daughter or your son might be having that thought going on, even though you've shut the conversation. Be extremely disconnected to hear what they're saying because insights come into play, where she actually thinks it's odd that she should take ownership not to be part of a diet. And those discussions are happening. What kind of counterbalancing is happening in our world now where we have to do this because the majority is saying that we should be seeing this as a high point? That is horrific, horrific to me. Okay, that was my personal therapy vent on this podcast.
Yes, no, thank you for sharing.
I'm going to tie it back to what we're saying, that same point about being able, if you hear something from someone, whether it be a child or even an adult you're working with, really listening to the schemas of why they're doing what they're doing is so revealing, not just for the practitioner who's helping, but for the individual. And many times people are afraid, or we don't ask enough questions. they don't feel like they can reveal, and we don't ask the right questions or pause enough to let them speak. I always tell parents this, like, don't just do open-ended questions to really allow a child or a teenager to really tell you why they're doing what they're doing with no judgment, with that distance, so to speak, the presence, being present, but being distant so they don't feel judgment. So much can be revealed in how somebody is feeling and why they're doing what they're doing. And if we don't allow people to have that, we can't help them. And they can't help themselves, because sometimes even by us not, you have to say it in order for them to say, oh my gosh, I can't believe I said that. That's the way I'm thinking. And that's what I need to change. That thing, not the action that I'm actually doing, but the mindset of why I'm doing what I'm doing. And that's a pretty big piece, I think, especially for our kids, because even when we change physiologically, our schemas in our head don't change automatically just because we've changed physiologically. We need to revisit those schemas. And it's when we revisit them coming from a different place that we're able to create more change as well in the way that we do things.
Right. I love what you guys just said. I want to add to it. Amy, when you said that, like, you grew up like in a large, we call it like a larger body, whatever, however you want to say, but like what intuitive eating talks about is that like bodies come in all shapes and sizes, and you guys do come from the same parents, right? And there's nature versus nurture, but like there's like, I tell moms, like when your child says I'm so fat, don't tell them you're not fat, you're beautiful, because you're saying fat equals not beautiful, right? So like, just like, I'm very careful with my language. And that's like the whole point of intuitive eating, is that like you could be healthy, you could pursue health at any size, you could change your behaviors without changing your weight, you know?
Right. I just want to say, like, I didn't even have those terms at all in my language. I never heard fat or overweight. I look at pictures now. I was 25 when I asked my mother, wait a second, like, you didn't get, like, you never said anything to me. She's like, I didn't care. It didn't matter in that generation. She's like, we weren't focused on that. We were focused on you guys being healthy and well. Again, amazing. The word, right. I grew up in a world where I was doing sports and athletics at a young age, not to lose weight, but just to be able to have movement. My father, may he rest in peace, grew up in Europe, where he was a boxer, and he had, when he did gymnastics, it was climbing ropes. So when he found out that my sister and I, we were in school and gym was a ball that we would roll around, or we would
talk,
he was like, where are you getting your movement in the city of New York? You know, there is no mountain for us to go to, or, you know, there was no player. So he arranged it for us. So I didn't grow up at all in this culture. I'm saying, for me, it's a shock. Amazing. And maybe I lived in a box.
No, I mean, who cares if you lived in a box? That's amazing.
Right.
Yeah, but today's culture also with movement sometimes is not just about movement. It's doing movement to be fit and thin. We're not saying it. We're always attaching all these phrases and all these schemas of why we're doing what we're doing, when it should just be, let's just move to feel good, to feel our bodies.
Right.
Dance parties, so like 24/7. Like, why not? Yeah.
I mean, I always say all forms of movement are good movement. You know, you could garden, you could run, you could go for a walk, and it does help regulate your nervous system, right? And 100%, I think, like, from what 100%. I read, like, burns adrenaline and really does clear your mind. And I'm obsessed with exercise, by the way. Like, I'm gonna share this for a second. If you could see my spin bike, like, I have two spin bikes in my. I'm obsessed with exercise.
We have a chin up bar in front of my kitchen, so when you come to me for a Shabbos or for a visit, you're doing pull ups, you know, before
it's
entering.
So it's amazing.
And my kids, my living room does not have a lot of couching because my kids are doing somersaults, and we do exercise every morning, the whole family. And anyone who's a good friend of mine, their kid knows that that's normal. Like, my kids are not odd at all. Like, they're thinking everyone else is off. Like, it doesn't take so much to get into that mode. Know that physical movement makes you happy. I mean, science has proven it. We know the endorphins that are released, but imagine if you're doing it to help your nervous system, to stop these loop responses. And we start young. Like, that's our mission. That is really what my sister and I have a mission for people to understand that we can get these loop responses going in a way where we don't have to talk to or talk down to kids. We can let them experience what it means for them to be comfortable in their own skin.
Yeah, I love it. It's amazing. And I think, like, everything that you guys are doing is, like, really life-changing. And I'm so glad that you're doing it. And I see such an overlap between what you guys do and what I do. I do actually talk about the food. And I do see that some people it helps, and some people, they probably need more of what you guys could offer, because there's like, again, like I said before, like I could talk until I'm blue in the face and I could teach them the whole intuitive eating journey and process, but there's still a little bit, you know, there's gaps, and that makes sense to me because everybody's so different and everybody needs different things. I also want to say one more thing. I wanted to say this before about like your mother never making a comment about your weight, right? And I forget exactly what you said, but like, basically what I tell my clients, and all of this is just from my learning, like I'm not a therapist. I never went to school to become a therapist, but I do a lot of my own education like you guys do. And I always say that like, whatever your strongest belief system is as a mom, your kids know it, whether you say it or not. How do we know? Because like you just said, Amy, your mom never said anything to you. By the way, I don't care about your weight, but you picked it up, right? Because she never said anything about your weight and she really didn't care. It wasn't that she was hiding it. So I think a lot of clients come to me because they're like, I'm so afraid. I don't care that my kid's fat, but everybody's going to tease them. I'm like, listen, it always hurts when you're teased, especially like I get that as somebody highly sensitive, but if they know that they're loved and accepted and their mom really does think that they're beautiful, it takes that like intenseness away. And like, that's what we want for our kids. Like we want to give them their sense of self from us, right? We don't want it to be like, well, their friend said this and I have to counter it, or I'm going to shut it down. I'm going to shut down the conversation. And like, that's where I feel like everything is so integrated. Like I heard Brené Brown say this once in an interview that like one of like the, like the one of the leading causes of death is like loneliness, like when she said that, and like I actually trust her research. And I was like, so funny, because everybody's like, the leading cause of death is like eating pizza, you know, is like being overweight. And like we don't allow ourselves to believe that, like, you know, when you feel sad, like you guys are talking about this, it affects all of our systems, and we feel, you know, like, and people don't like believe that.
And also, just, I love what you're sharing, Gila, because how about let's build on that? Just one more point. And if you're feeling sad, be sad. It's okay. Right. You don't have to not sit with it. Sit with it. Right. Allow yourself to be there. Like if I would have come home and said, you know, they're mocking me and they're teasing me, and then my mother would share the experience, the moment she denies, oh, you don't need to be worrying about that.
Right.
I don't exist. Right. I don't exist. And then you denied who I am. When my daughter is saying it's bothering her and she doesn't, I need to have a dialogue with her. I can't squash that because for some reason she's thinking about it. You know, I'm looking at the chat because we are doing this live, and someone was
just getting my charger, by the way.
Okay, sure. Someone was saying it's interesting because she grew up with the older generation. We're super focused on not being heavy. That tells you the dynamic that we are so individual. Again, each person, each soul that's on this planet, every client that you have, we're stepping into a world of nature, nurture, genetics, physiology, stories that have not been told sometimes. I'm sure, Gila, in your journey, people will share about traumatic responses and what they connect to food. Mm-hmm. There's so much more than just what meets the surface. And that's why I appreciate these kind of dialogues, because we get to see the different perspectives and the unifying perspective. Like you said over and over again, we're doing similar things. Yeah. Yeah. We are human. We are all human. We just have to figure out what it is we need personally to help ourselves and go and get it done. And it's not a checklist. It's a lifelong journey of growing and reconnecting. And let me tell you, your nervous system changes until the day you die. So stay on top of it.
It's so cool. I want to say one more thing. I hope it's not like too triggering, but just because it just came up for me when we were talking about this, that like I've had many clients that have been sexually abused. And of course they use food to cope with that, whether it's numbing on hunger, numbing on fullness, just feeling horrible, a lot of disgust. And what I've found like over and over again is that like, if a mom said like, oh, it's not such a big deal, or if it happens in every family, like you said, you don't like the trauma, like the pain, the amount of therapy necessary is, you can't compare it to a client who was, you know, of course it's traumatic, but somebody saw them, somebody helped them, somebody was there for them, somebody validated them. And it's like, we think, again, like we said before, like, oh, those are just like nice things to do, validate someone. But really, like, I do believe that it affects your physiology. I do believe that it affects all the schemas in your head. It how could it not? And like, I just see it so much with my clients. Like, that's a perfect example of like, this client is doing okay and this client is not doing okay because she was told like, what's the big deal that you were sexually abused? You know, like, it's real.
Science is proving this, Gila. We're seeing it over and over again. There are scientific studies that are done on folks who are orphans, who've been neglected, those who were taken in as babies, and how their brains, even if they were separated by birth, twin studies that show, and it's the whole ACEs study, right? Which is talking about traumatic responses, those who may have been sexually abused and what their results are in their development of diabetes, obesity. They did like a 25 or 30 year study where they followed up with these folks. We see how their entire brain chemistry and their physiological needs will shift because of that. This is really, really critical.
Yeah. I was just going to add to that, because especially when we do our self-regulated life, or we do work privately with clients, some of them do it privately through us. And I was just thinking of this one client where we were talking about our reflection and our perception of ourselves and bringing self-compassion in for you personally. Like when you're able to do that for yourself, you're able to do that for others. And she was talking about the relationship that she had with her mother. Like the realization was that it was, oh my gosh, something that my mother told me, or the way that she treated me, and trying to make peace with that and trying to mend that relationship, when I was trying to steer her to understand that it's the things that weren't said. And you know what? Parents don't mean sometimes what they're saying. They don't realize the impact. We're all trying to do the best with parenting. You don't realize that it's hopefully these things, when we're talking about it, it makes someone pause and say, hey, how is it that I'm communicating? What is the language I'm using? What is the message? And for this person, that was an eye-opening moment where if she can let go of that, or see she is not what her mother said that she was, especially, I mean, this is a 45-year-old woman who has 5 kids of her own. And one of the realizations she made was, oh my gosh, how am I speaking to my children? Am I repeating what I'm hearing, even though I'm trying to work on myself? Because she hasn't let make peace with that, who knows how she's speaking? So it's really about what you were saying, that validation and the acknowledgement of, we are a product of our upbringing and the things that are said to us. But it doesn't mean that we are what was said to us. We are who we are. We're born perfect. We are perfect. However we are in that moment, we're just looking to enhance who we are and really get to the core of who we are. And I think it's an important point, whatever it is we're dealing with, whether it's eating, whether we're dealing with like just, you know, our perception of ourselves, all these things are key and can really make an impact on ourselves as well as a future generation.
So true. Do you guys want to wrap up, or do you want to keep going?
Yeah, if we could, please. Yes.
Let's wrap up. I wanted to say one more thing, and then I'm gonna get done. That's why I never use the words healthy or unhealthy, by the way, because when we tell a kid this is not healthy, but then we give it to them, we confuse them. I like to just use, I know it's really confusing because I don't
What's
have
your like, word?
Okay, I know it's really confusing because I don't have words, but my supervisor, she always says, just call the food what it is. These are chips. And these are apples. This is meal food. This is snack food. Maybe you don't agree with me.
I need to interrupt you. My daughter came home from pre-1A. This was a couple of years ago, with a project. There was a face.
Oh, I remember this.
Body was the foods. And there's one picture where she's smiling and one where she's sad. And on the smiling picture, it happened to be, it had all the foods like cake, candy, cookies. And the sad picture was vegetables and fruits and all proteins and things like that. And I remember telling her, oh, what is this about? I said, is this what you enjoy, what you don't enjoy? She's like, no, I'm supposed to be sad when I eat these foods, and I'm supposed to be happy when I eat these foods. So I look at it and I'm like, I think something went wrong. I went on the class chat and I found out that her pictures were reversed, that she should have been happy with the vegetables because they were teaching healthy and unhealthy choices.
Yeah.
And I told my husband, I'm keeping this forever. This is exactly the issue. Like, I'm happy. She went with what she likes, and that's what she perceived. Like what you said about healthy, unhealthy.
Right.
A piece of chocolate might be healthy in that moment for that person, healthy.
It's context.
Yes. So, and you know what? A broccoli or a cabbage might be making someone feel terribly afterwards and heavy, and that's not the right food. So I think my daughter and that mistake was living proof of how we should really be teaching food choices. So you triggered that in me when you said healthy, unhealthy. Sorry, go ahead.
So we're good. Thank you guys so much for joining.
Thank you.
Will be available for rewatch on Instagram, right? LinkedIn. It will be available on my podcast for audio. And if you guys, I'll put all your information in the show notes so people could reach out to you if they want to do any of your courses or classes. And it's been a pleasure. I really enjoyed this conversation. I learned so much. I know that my listeners will learn so much, and your listeners. And thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Gila. All right. Take care. We're going to take it home now.
Okay.
Thank you all so much for being here on my podcast, Get Into It with Gila. If you'd like to learn more about what I do and what intuitive eating is, please visit my website at www.gilaglassberg.com or follow me on Instagram at Gila Glassberg. Thank you so much. Have a great day.